Accession number 19941, Reel 2.
Kenneth Warburton, Reel 2.
Right, we were... The Rodney, at the end of the war with Germany, was due to visit Copenhagen, and I was looking forward to this. However, I got instructions to report back to Plymouth Division, the reason being that I was required to accompany the Prime Minister and his entourage to the Berlin Conference to be held at Potsdam.
Just before we go on to Potsdam, what were your living conditions like in Rodney?
Reasonable, you know, as more or less best you can have as a ship. You had to sleep in a hammock at night, and that was an unusual experience, but nevertheless, I wouldn't say they were bad. A bit cramped, probably.
Whereabouts in the ship were you?
Below deck. I wouldn't like to think what deck we were on, but... It was above water level, but below the main deck level.
How did the Marines get on with the sailors aboard ship?
Quite well, usually, because we were required largely for different things if it got into action. I mean, we would probably do any landings that were required, not the sailors. But of course, I never had the experience of this because we were in Scapa Flow all the time.
What was life like at Scapa Flow?
It was quite nice. It was colder up there, but not too cold. We had one little scary night. On this night, it was suspected that U-boats had got into the flow itself. And we were put into a boat which... and armed with a machine gun to hunt these U-boats if they ever surfaced. And these were these two men submarines, which had somehow been thought to have got in. However, we never ever saw any, and assumed after it had been some types of fish which had probably jumped over the barriers into the flow. So it was a night without any sleep.
Could you have much in the way of entertainment up there?
Not a lot. We were taken on one occasion to Kirkwall itself, which is the sort of capital of the Orkney Islands, and did a tour. And we used to go to Flotta, another island, and play hockey and football in the afternoons, and also go for walks on the islands, but not a... much else in the way of entertainment, because we didn't have television them days, and the only thing that was radios.
Did you get visits by ENSA or anything like that?
Not to my knowledge.
Did you get any air raids?
Again, not to my knowledge there at all, but again, this was coming towards the end of the war, and of course the Germans were very much on the retreat, so well, there had been attacks on the floe because one of the battleships was sunk there by U-boats, which was the cause of the scare when we were there. But whether there was any air raids there, I don't know, and I'm certain there wasn't any in the time I was there.
No, you were just about to take me through Potsdam Conference, please.
Yes, well, I had to report back to Plymouth, and then it was the same again, go up to London, Office of the War Cabinet, and then take the things we picked up to Northolt Aerodrome, where we flew in a consolidated privateer to Gatow Airport, or Gadow Airport, which is near Potsdam. It was the most awful flight I'd ever been on. We then alighted at the airport, picked up the vehicles which had been allocated to us, and then went to down the Potsdam Autobahn to Babelsberg, where everyone was quartered in the British delegation, in a street called Ringstrasse, which had been occupied by the film stars in which the Russians had cleared out pretty well everything that was in there and just put the basic necessities, like your beds and cupboards to put things in and all that sort of thing.
Did you see much of the Russians?
Quite a lot. Of course, we were on duty at the Sasilianov. The Russian delegates and the British delegates came in by the, well, I will say it's a back entrance. It was the entrance where the Red Star is, in a sort of courtyard. And then both the American and British delegates came in that way, but there was a member of the Russian Kremlin Guard, one of our elite, and also one FBI agent to check everybody coming in. And the Russian delegation came in at the main entrance, which is in the main grounds of the Sasilianov, and the Stalin, Molotov, and the Kremlin Guard came in three separate Rolls-Royce looking cars with windows you couldn't really see through, and they used to alight and come in the main way. And we were on duty in teams of three continually. That's one Russian, one FBI agent, and one Romney.
Did you get a close-up view of the Russian VIPs?
Oh, yes. A very close-up view one night. Because on Winston Churchill's birthday, he invited Joseph Stalin to attend, and he came along, and of course I was on duty by chance that night. And in the house, there was me alone on duty, and outside we had the Scots Guards. And Stalin brought his Kremlin Guard with him, and they joined the Scots Guards outside, but of course they couldn't come in because he had no jurisdiction to bring them in the church, the house that Winston Churchill had. So he came in, came right up to me, looked me right in the eyes, looked me up and down, then gave a tiny smile, and then went in to join Winston Churchill. So I was on duty until the party ended at that. Whether Truman came in or not, I don't know, because I was on duty from, I think, 8 o'clock onwards. He may have come before I went on duty. I don't know. Or maybe just Joseph Stalin was there. I don't know.
What did Stalin look like?
Much as you've seen him, the thing, he didn't look a very friendly person, but authoritative. But apart from that, it's hard to say, because he didn't speak, obviously.
How was he dressed?
In military uniform.
Was he tall or short?
Shorter than me. I would say he's something about 5'8", 5'9", at the most.
Did you react when he smiled?
Not really, because it wasn't the tiniest, you know, as though he was accepting me. But obviously you keep discipline and you don't.
How did the party go?
Well, we didn't go inside to loop, you know, it must have gone. It was fairly quiet. There wasn't any noise to any extent or anything like that. But so there was some camaraderie there. I say I often wondered whether President Truman was there or not, but of course I say I didn't see him come in, and to get in the room where the birthday party was being held, he would have to come where I was, and he certainly didn't when on the 4 hours I was on duty. And we got on, you know, quite well with the FBI and the Russians we were on duty with. I certainly thought the Russians were much more effective than the FBI were, though the FBI got a lot more pay.
In what way were the Russians more effective?
Well, I thought they were much more disciplined, really, than the FBI. What? Well, again, that's to be expected, isn't it? Because if they're soldiers and things like that and train for that, whereas the FBI are trained for police work. So there is a difference.
Can you be more specific about the lack of discipline of the FBI?
Not really. It just contrasted to what we are and what the Russians are. But again, we were military people and the FBI weren't. But the Canadian Mounted Police seemed a bit more like us.
Was it a question of alertness?
Not really. More easy going. Where we were constantly on vigil, you know. I wouldn't say that we're not good at the job or anything, but there was a difference. Probably caused by discipline and what the main task of the people you were on duty with was normally.
What other memories have you got from this time?
Well, the Cecilianov was a beautiful place, you know, and surprisingly, the Red Star and Geranium were done in the courtyard there in 1945, were still there a couple of years ago when a friend of mine who had told about this went to Berlin and he actually took these pictures, and it's still there, or it was 2 years ago. So that's been there 50 odd years.
Were there any hitches in the work which you had to do?
Not to my knowledge. No.
Had any problems been anticipated with the Germans?
I don't think so. You didn't see any German military. All you saw was civilians and... I think they weren't having all that good a time because this was the Russian sector. We were given one day off there and taken round by the Brandenburg Gate and also visited the Reichschancellery. And the Russians were on duty there and it was still, you know, the blaze and bombardment it had was still apparent. And we were given some Iron Crosses, unissued Iron Crosses, as a gift by the Russians when we went in there. But they were no value because they said they were unissued ones. But it's a memory of it, and I gave them all to friends anyway, so I haven't got them. And you couldn't say you didn't want them. And
how were the Russians behaving from what you saw?
Well, quite well, you know, because again, the Russians who were with us were the top quality military, and I don't think you would find them behaving other than well at any time. They're too disciplined. It's when you get the more ones who haven't had the training and all that sort of thing that you get lack of discipline and that kind of thing that arises from that.
Did you see any of these low-level Russian troops?
No. We knew there were camps where there were large numbers of Russian troops, but we only really contacted two types. One were the ones on duty with us, and the other type were the ones who were in the buffet and making the meals there, who made some very good meals, though they didn't speak to you much at all or anything like that. And also, when you travel by car there, you had the Russian ladies directing traffic with two flags and the Russian machine gunner next to them. And the lady would often smile at you, but the man never did, when he wasn't looking. But these were just people you passed who were guiding traffic. But them was the only ones we actually came in contact with, where we know there was camps of them very near, but... one thing that happened in the houses that's Film Stars' houses we occupied in Babelsberg, was the Russians had cleared everything out pretty well, tapestries, all sorts of things, and most of this was burned. They then put in beds for us, cupboards to put our things in, and all that sort of thing, but most of the initial furniture was destroyed.
Why had they done this?
Probably to make the thing more basic, I should imagine. I don't know. But
But this had happened before you came?
Just before we came.
So how do you know that it had happened?
Of course we were, you know, told that. And undoubtedly it had, because there'd obviously been some very good furniture and effects there. They weren't there then. And I said the Russians had, to our knowledge, taken the alarm clocks. But didn't seem to have any value of things like tapestries. But some of this you actually may have seen little incidents of, and the rest of it was what people told you.
How long were you on duty at this conference?
We did generally about 4 hours at a time, something of that nature. And there'd be two of you, of each, so you could relieve each other.
What were you armed with?
We were armed with bayonets, and the others with guns, with revolvers.
So you didn't have any bullets in your weapon?
No.
You had a
but
rifle.
Again, we had rifles, but not there, not on duty there. Where, to my mind, a rifle is a useful weapon, where a revolver, unless you're very close to someone, isn't. Because revolvers tend to throw bullets out, so they're not going direct unless you're lucky or very close to someone. So I often look at these American stories and wonder if they're true. Or at least they must have been very close to each other when this gunfighting with revolvers went on. Whereas a rifle can be a very deadly weapon at several hundred yards.
So you just had a sidearm?
Yes. And we never had cause to use them. So.
Had you heard any rumours about German resistance?
Only when we found these porcelain badges, which were in a trunk in the place we were in. And they were small porcelain badges, exceedingly well done. But that's all we'd heard about them, and the fact that they were in the Black Forest, and they were called the Werewolves. But never any time did we know of any action these people had taken.
What did the badges look like?
They were just small, circular, made of porcelain and very, very good quality.
But what did they show on the badge?
I've forgotten now, but it was a picture and writing on them.
But it related to the werewolves?
Well, that's what we were told, but I've never heard of them again, ever. But obviously they're related to something, because they were quality things.
Where were these found?
Say, in the houses we were, film stars' houses.
Were you and the other people on duty given any memento for having been there?
No.
Any other memories from Potsdam?
Not really. It was a unique experience being with Russians. And I thought, you know, had a good impression by the type of quality of people we were on duty with, and for the fact of their cooking, which was marvellous when we went to their buffet. But again, the ATS girls' cooking was very good. We had cherry pie, and we've never had it since anything like that. It was marvellous.
How long did the conference last for you?
I wouldn't like to say now. It's hard to say. It lasted 2 or 3 weeks, I think. Difficult, because when it was over we went again by car back to Potsdam Autobahn, and this time came back thankfully on a Douglas DeCarter plane to Northolt, and that was a wonderful flight, entirely opposite of the first flight.
What was exactly wrong with this first flight to Gatow?
Well, it must have been turbulence, but it was a terrible journey.
And what kind of a plane was it?
Consolidated Privateer. I've never heard of it since, and I wouldn't want to.
What happened to you after this?
The on my return to Plymouth, I was then allowed to go on a fortnight's holiday. That's leave for a fortnight. And then I was then sent out east. I believe, initially, I was told by a friend in the office that I would probably go out to the High Flyer, not High Flyer camp, the Golden Hind camp at Sydney. But when I got my orders, it was for the High Flyer in Ceylon, at Kurunagala in the primeval forest. So I went there on the Athlone Castle, which sailed to Colombo. From Colombo we went by train to Kurunagala, and from Kurunagala we were taken to the camp, the High Flyer camp, which was about 5 miles away. Kurunagala was a small village, and we used to go there to go to the Naffy. There was a Naffy there.
What was this High Flyer camp?
Well, it was a camp in the primeval forest, which again was where people stayed until they were posted somewhere, and where they did a certain amount of training. And we stayed in things like huts, and at night you had a lantern, and of course this used to often attract things like flying ants. And in the morning the floor would be full of the wings of these creatures. And of course we had kept mongoose in the huts because of the snakes that was in the area.
Did you have any trouble with snakes?
I got bit once with one, but I was lucky. It was either a grass snake or it was one that had poisoned something else. And I had the bite marks in my leg for about a year, but felt no real effect of it.
How did that come about?
Well, I used to, on my days off, go into the forest and, on my own, because it charmed me there. Wonderful butterflies, birds, the scenery, the flowers, you know, it was out of this world. And rather than sit around and do things like that, I used to go out there, but nobody would come with me. It was one of them things. And given that, I always had this good sense of direction. I could go out somewhere like that and get back at the time I wished to. And it was something I really enjoyed. Eventually, while we were there, we had one trip given to us, and that took us to Kandy, where we saw the Temple of the Tooth. This is a sort of main building in Ceylon at that time. And we also were taken to a football ground at a place called Diataloya, and allowed to stay overnight and play football there. And I once played for the Royal Marines against the Navy at Snake Pit, Colombo, which was the international football ground for Ceylon, and we beat the Navy 4-2. And for once I had a good game, which is one of these rare occasions. And then eventually I was posted onto HMS Glasgow, so I had to go to Trincomalee, joined the Glasgow, and for the first two or three trips it was going to Singapore and bringing troops, ex-prisoners of war, back again to Trincomalee, where they were then picked up by other ships and taken back to England or America or wherever else they were going to.
What condition were the ex-POWs in?
They weren't too bad, but again, the war had then been over a few months and they'd probably been fed well and all that sort of thing, so you didn't see them immediately what they were like at the end of the war with Japan.
How did you like being in HMS Glasgow?
Well, I enjoyed it because you got around to places. You know, Singapore is very different then than it is now. Very much the Arab Quarter where we used to go, because that was the port at that time, or the port we went into. We had also one journey to Surabaya in the Dutch East Indies, because the war was then on between the Dutch and the Indonesians. And we went ashore there, and it seemed a beautiful place, full of graffiti everywhere. You heard occasional bullets, and you heard dogs barking, but never saw anyone. And also, before we left that area, we were involved in the Indian naval mutiny at Bombay. And we went up to Bombay, but the Indian Navy surrendered before we arrived there. So we had a few days looking around Bombay.
What were these graffiti in Surabaya?
Well, it's like you find it in London in places now, just graffiti on the walls. And you know, there were beautiful bungalows and it kind of pulled them down a bit, but there was just nobody there.
Did you understand what the graffiti said?
No.
What did you see in Bombay?
Well, I remember, my main memory is going down Grant Road to Crawford Market, and this was a market where they sell all sorts of marvellous rugs and all that sort of thing. But it seemed a place of very poor people, you know, that some place I wouldn't like to live, and felt sorry for the people who did live.
What was the attitude of the population to you?
Well, they weren't unfriendly. They didn't, you know, mix with you very much unless you approached them, but they seemed to sort of accept that you were there, and we had no trouble with them whatever.
Were you in Marine uniform?
Oh yes, always in Marine uniform.
Did you feel unsafe or threatened?
No.
Were you armed?
No.
Were you by yourself?
No, we were usually groups of three or four.
Were you given any warnings about going about in Bombay?
No, not to my knowledge.
You were just given freedom to do what you like?
Yes, but again, we were told where things were to look at and things like that, like Crawford Market, and we probably only had about three times we were ashore. And I think I went to the place one or three times because it was very, very unusual.
Did you buy anything in Bombay?
No. Didn't really have the money in them days to buy things.
What happened next?
Well, we then had to go for a refit, so we went back to Trincomalee, then down to Mauritius, to Port Louis, which we call that, on the way down to Simonstown, South Africa. And the Glasgow went into Simonstown for a major refit. I was then put ashore, no longer in the crew of the Glasgow, and went to work on the rifle range at Simonstown, where people were trained, awaiting a ship to take me back to the UK because I was due for demob. I was probably in Simonstown for about 2 to 3 months.
What was that like?
Well, it had its place things, you know. There was a big naval compound there, and in there was a memorial there built to a dog called Nuisance, an Alsatian dog. And this used to, when it was dark at night, go to get the trains from Simonstown to Cape Town and patrol it, looking after naval ratings. Not Marines, just the naval ratings. And actually there's a book about the dog. Since coming home, I've only met two people who've known about it, but obviously an unusual story.
When were you demobbed?
In October, I arrived back in October 1946, and I was then on demob leave until my service ran out.